we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. It's day 9 of the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament in New York. Highlighting Monday's Day 8 action, American star Serena Williams advanced to the quarterfinals, as we hear now from the AP's Graham Agars.
Serena Williams struggled for the second match in a row, but reached the U.S. Open quarterfinals anyway, keeping alive her bid for a 24th Slam title. Williams took 2.5 hours to overcome Maria Sakkari 6-3 in the third.
She's such a good competitor. It was a really intense match.
That to set up a showdown with Bulgarian Svetlana Pironkova. A shot loss, though, for the second seed Sofia Kenin, who fell in straight sets to the 16th seed Elise Mertens. Her reward, a quarterfinal clash with a resurgent Victoria Azarenka.
Hi, I'm Francis Tiafoe. You're listening to Sunny Side of Sports on Voice of America.
Disappointment as well for Francis Tiafoe. He managed just 5 games against the third seed Daniil Medvedev, but good wins for Dominic Thiem and Alex de Minaur. I'm Graham Agars.
Thanks, Graham. Turning to table tennis, Africa's highest-ranked player, Aruna Quadri, lost his first match Sunday in Germany's Bundesliga. The 32-year-old Nigerian recently joined the German club TTC Ronsprudel Fulda Mabersel. He was beaten by Kilian Ort of TSV Bad Königshofen team 3-1, and Quadri's team lost overall 3-0. In an interview afterwards with Iron Mike Mbonye, Aruna Quadri expressed his disappointment.
I think it was not a very good experience because we lost the first match. It was a very bad debut for me. I started very well today and I couldn't build on my first set performance. I think I lost concentration after I won the first set, and that actually cost me the whole of the match. My opponent concentrated more than high, and hopefully in the next match, I will learn from this mistake of concentration. I think it's a very good and strong, similarly unique league because of the level of play in the Bundesliga, because there are a lot of top players in top 100, and for that reason, it's a unique and strong league. Today, I think I have learned from my losing concentration. So in the next match, I'm going to be giving everything from the beginning to the end.
Can you tell Sunny Side of Sports listeners how your team fared on the opening day of the German Table Tennis Bundesliga?
Similarly, I can say that it was a very bad day for the team. Philosophen started very well. He was 2-0 up, and Bastian Steyer came back much more stronger, and he lost. Frank Baur was not doing very bad, but I think if we had some kind of luck in the match, probably we might have even done much more better than today. Of course, losing part of the game, so we will work more harder and come back more stronger in the next matches.
It appeared you did not play your usual game on Sunday. What can be attributed to this?
I personally think I did not perform up to expectations, but of course, that is part of sport. Similarly, I was a little bit nervous today, and I could not even explain why I was so nervous. I think I actually have nothing to prove to anyone. I was just planning to do my thing, play my game, but somehow before the match, I was somehow nervous. I've been playing in Germany for years, but not in the league. I've played in Champions League, in Pro Tour, in World Championships. Several tournaments I've played in Germany, but somehow today I was somehow nervous, and I really didn't know. The whole of the team was not satisfied with our performance today. The directors of the club were so sad because of the loss. And probably we'll come back much more stronger in the next matches.
That's Aruna Quadri, Africa's highest-ranked table tennis player. And Aruna spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Germany.
Sporty greetings. I'm Aruna Quadri, Nigerian professional table tennis player, presently playing for Ron Sprudel, Fudal, Mabase Club of Germany. You're listening to the Sony Side of Sport on the Voice of America. Please continue to stay safe and avoid contacting COVID-19. Thanks.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Ghana and Crystal Palace striker Jordan Ayew is a member of a proud footballing family. His father is Ghanaian great Abedi Pele, a three-time African Footballer of the Year. And Jordan's uncles and brothers are all current or former professional football players. Jordan was born in Marseille, France, where his father was a star player. Jordan himself began his club career with Marseille in 2009 and scored 14 goals in 111 appearances with the French club. Since joining Crystal Palace in 2018, Jordan has made 57 appearances and scored 10 goals. Yawa Fusu-Larbi in Accra caught up with Jordan Ayew to ask him about his football career. Here's Yao.
Well, Jordan, welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. What is it like to be in a family that you were born in, given that your dad, uncle, and brothers are all very good footballers?
As being in IU, I'm lucky to be part of the massive family. And to be fair, it comes with a lot of pressure, but I think pressure is a good thing if you take it in a positive way. And I think it's a bit of a shame that my dad and my mom, they can't watch the games because of anxiety, stress, or I think it's a bit of a shame is because parents, I'm a parent too, so I know how it feels. I now understand how it feels. At the beginning I couldn't really understand, but now I kind of understand, but yeah, it's just, I think it's a shame, but as long as at least they keep an eye, so this is a good thing.
How influential has the manager, Roy Hodgson, been for you in your time at Crystal Palace?
First of all, I'll have to thank him and the staff and the board as well of Crystal Palace. I think during the training sessions, even if on the weekend things weren't going the way we all wanted, during the training sessions, I was showing good things. So I think that's what pushed them to make it permanent. And then obviously when I go back from the AFCON, I think the AFCON is just, before even I went to the AFCON, I had to change my mentality. I had to change a lot of things I was doing previously. And I think everything paid off. So I just think that it's just something that in life where you get to a certain age where you start to realize some things and you start to think differently and you start to not look at other people, you start to look at yourself. Don't accuse people, you just start to look at yourself and ask yourself what you have to change, what you have to do to improve and everything. And I think it's my mentality that changed a lot. And I think the manager saw that my mentality has changed a lot. And obviously, you know, I forced him and I fought hard and I pushed him to give me the opportunity to prove myself on week in, week out.
I think last season was a very successful one for you. You scored many goals for Palace and in effect, it took your number of goals way past Tony Yeboah, who had scored most goals for Ghana in the Premiership. Now, how do you feel after surpassing his record and sort of creating your own record in the English Premier League?
Well, I think we're talking about one of the best strikers of Ghana, or maybe one of the best strikers of all time that Ghana have ever had. So obviously, it's a good achievement for me, my family, for the country as well. But it's not really important to me for now, because I have more games ahead of me. So I just need to focus and do the best that I can.
What have you changed about your game in the past few months that has changed your game so much?
Well, it's not much. It's not that much. It's just honesty. I promised to myself that by the time I stop playing this game, I'll make sure that I have no regrets. And I'll make sure, like, I have an obligation now. And I have an obligation, and my obligation is to make sure that every weekend when I step on the pitch, every game, whether it's for Black Stars, whether it's for my club, when I step on the pitch and our supporters, my family, the population of Africa or Ghana are taking just 2 hours or 3 hours to watch the Premier League, I have to make sure I'm at my best. Those are the little things, and I think I need to be at my best every weekend, all the time. And honestly, I'm going to give myself, I give 100%, 110%, 120%, I'll make sure that I kill myself on the pitch each weekend. And that is a promise I made to myself. And I think now, like, that is the direction I'm going to. So I just don't want, I didn't realize some little things because I was a bit naive, and obviously you say maybe it's because of this person. You start to look around people, you don't want to look at yourself, but I think you need to look at yourself, and those are the little things that have changed. So.
After scoring the most goals at Crystal Palace last season, don't you think there's going to be a sense that defenders will see you in a different light and be more rigorous in their tackles on you?
Yeah, of course. I know that now defenders are going to see me in a different way. I know that it's going to be difficult. It's not going to be easy, but nothing has been easy for me throughout my career, so I'm ready for it. I'm ready for the challenge. And like I said, I just have my basic things to do. And if I do my basic things, then I don't see why things won't go on well.
Ghana has not won the Africa Cup of Nations since 1982. Now that you're an integral member of the squad, are you hopeful of winning it for the country?
The only thing, like I said, I wouldn't regret, because I would have given my best to try. But if I don't win it, fine. The young ones will come and do and make history, and that's the law of the game. If Abedipele and Tonyebo were still playing, I don't think I'll have a chance to play in the Black Stars. So the moment is coming soon. So we'll do our best. We'll give our 100% to try and win this trophy, and we'll see what happens. If we don't, then the next generation will come and make history for the country, for ourselves as well.
That's Ghana and Crystal Palace striker Jordan Ayew. And he spoke with Yao Afusu-Larbi in Accra. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossings, where we feature music and interviews along with your favorite artists from around the world. Tune in and interact live with us here in Washington, D.C.
Hello, Shirin.
Hello, Larry. How are you?
Good. How are you tonight?
Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT.
World Athletics recently marked the 29th anniversary of what many track and field fans describe as the greatest men's long jump competition in history. Americans Mike Powell and Carl Lewis leaped and spurred each other on to greater and greater distances at the World Championships in Tokyo.
Powell would eventually reach 8 meters 95, a world record that still stands today. The energetic Andy Edwards witnessed that long jump jamboree in the Japanese capital, and he joins us now with his reflections.
In 40 years of covering athletics as a journalist, I've had three work trips to Japan. Firstly, to the pre-Olympic holding camp in Chiba, near Tokyo, for the British and American teams before the 1988 Games in Seoul, and then the World Championships in Tokyo, 1991, and lastly, the 2007 World Championships in Osaka. Each trip has made a lasting imprint on my mind, not only for the competition, but because Japan feels quite unlike anywhere else my work has taken me, and that includes other countries in Asia. Yes, you can eat rice and noodles elsewhere, but nothing feels quite like Japan. Attention to detail and meticulous planning were the hallmarks of the organisers of the championships, setting a standard which was amply matched by the competition, and for me, above all, the men's long jump final. Here's some background. Carl Lewis went into the final as the reigning world champion. He was the king of track and field in terms of men's sprints and long jump, had won four golds at the Los Angeles Olympics in 1984, emulating the achievement of his fellow American Jesse Owens at the Berlin Games in 1936. He repeated that feat in Seoul, 4 years after Los Angeles, notably after the first man across the line in the 100 metres final, Ben Johnson of Canada, had tested positive for drugs. Before Tokyo in 1991, he had won 65 consecutive long jump finals, and his last defeat was 10 years previously. He radiated star quality, and he knew it, but given his achievements, he was entitled to do so. By that time, his chief rival for the long jump was his fellow American Mike Powell. Well, rival, yes, but in their previous 14 encounters, Powell had lost to Lewis in every one, including the Olympic final in Seoul, when he finished second. When Carl Lewis was a teenage star, Mike Powell had barely begun his career as a long jumper, and that was his specialist event, rather than being a great sprinter like Lewis. Here's a personal note. Once I had adapted to different time zones, the heat and humidity of Tokyo in August, covering these championships was among the best work experiences I've ever had. After each morning session, I would send my radio reports, then hurry out of the stadium, catch the metro for the short distance to my hotel, then into running kit and run up and down some side street for about 20 minutes. I needed that break in what were always long working days. Still dripping from the shower, I would be back in regular clothes and cross to the Sendagaya metro station for a dish of the greatest fast food I've ever had. My favourite was onion noodles, eaten standing up in a small, crowded booth. 10 minutes or so on the metro and I was back in the Olympic Park and ready to prepare for the afternoon session, which would end late at night. For all that I mention heat and humidity, the temperature dropped by mid-evening to be just about ideal for sprints and field events. Cue then the long jump final. Carl Lewis began well, clearing 8 metres 68 in round one, while Mike Powell was well short of 8 metres. It looked as if King Carl was about to ascend the throne once again, especially when he jumped further than Bob Beamon's world record distance of 8 metres 90 set in the Mexico Olympics 23 years before. But Lewis's mark of 8 metres 91 in round three had a following wind stronger than the legal limit, so it did not count as a world record. Halfway through the final of six rounds, Mike Powell had found his rhythm, landing a solid 8 metres 54. In round four, he had a big jump, threatening Lewis's lead, but it was invalid because he was judged to have put a toe over the line on the jump board. That left him with two more chances. Well, he used the next supremely well. He went far, far into the long jump pit, knew it was a big distance, and when the world record of 8 metres 95 came up with the following wind inside the legal limit, Powell charged around the infield, shouting to his coach sitting in the stands, Randy Huntington, "It's mine!" Indeed it was. Well, though Carl Lewis jumped in his remaining efforts, Mike Powell had the world record as well as the world title. He retained that world long jump title in Stuttgart in 1993. Carl Lewis went on to win a fourth Olympic long jump gold in Atlanta in 96. These days, the online world means you can watch their contest over and over again, not least to admire the Japanese television coverage, which captures their faces in critical moments. It's a story of timeless drama. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Andy Edwards in London.
I'm Kendra Harrison. I'm the 100 hurdle world record holder for Team USA, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Thanks, Haiti. That's my VOA colleague, Haiti Fitzpatrick. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. In National Basketball Association playoff action Monday night, the Boston Celtics and Los Angeles Clippers both posted victories in Orlando, Florida. The Celtics routed the defending NBA champion Toronto Raptors, as we hear now from the AP's Dave Ferry.
The Celtics own a 3-2 series lead after Jaylen Brown scored 27 points in a 111-89 blowout over the Raptors.
Got to come out ready to fight every single night. If not, then that's how you lose. So our guys came out ready to fight tonight. We got to come out ready to fight tomorrow. Next game.
Kemba Walker scored 21 for the Celtics, whose starters outscored Toronto's top five by a whopping 93-45. The Raptors shot 2-for-15 during their first 18 possessions to fall behind 18-5. A 23-7 Boston run put the Celtics up by 28 late in the first half. Fred VanVleet scored 18 for Toronto, but Pascal Siakam and Kyle Lowry managed only 10 apiece. Game 6 is Wednesday. I'm Dave Ferry.
Thanks, Dave. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Clippers used their defense and a big game from their star forward to beat the Denver Nuggets. The AP's Bruce Morton reports.
The Clippers turned up the defense down the stretch, good enough for a 113-107 win over the Nuggets. LA leads the best of seven series 2-1. Paul George was game high for the Clips with 32 points.
I had it going early. I just kept attacking, stayed aggressive. Just let the game come to me.
The Nuggets led by as many as 12 and were still up 101-99, but that's when Los Angeles went on a 12-2 run for a 111-103 lead with 117 to go. Denver's Nikola Jokic poured in a team-high 32. Game 4 is on Wednesday. I'm Bruce Morton.
Thanks, Bruce. The NBA playoffs continue later Tuesday night with two more games in Orlando, Florida. The Milwaukee Bucks will play the Miami Heat, and that will be followed by a game between the Los Angeles Lakers and the Houston Rockets. The Heat lead the Bucks 3-1 and can advance to the next round with a victory Tuesday night. Meanwhile, the best of seven series between the Lakers and the Rockets is tied at 1 each. With Milwaukee facing a must-win situation in Game 5, the Bucks are hopeful their superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo can play. Giannis had round-the-clock treatment Monday on his sprained right ankle. He's the NBA's reigning most valuable player, and he also recently won the league's Defensive Player of the Year award. And that wraps up the September 8th edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the sunny side of sports.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues.
It's about listening to them
and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.